Thank you all for being here for Political Rewind today. I'm Bill Nygut. Lots to talk about, including a new candidate in the U.S. Senate race, the Democratic Senate race against David Perdue. We're joined today by Mary Margaret Oliver, State Representative from Decatur. Mary Margaret, I have missed you. You've had a busy summer. You're just back from a week at a beach. Do we tell people, do we disclose publicly where you go for vacation or no?
One of the places I went this summer, Southwest Harbor, Maine, which is a fabulous place.
Oh, absolutely wonderful. I'm glad you're back. We missed you.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Mark Rountree, a Republican pollster, political consultant. He runs Landmark Communications. I say whenever you're in here, Mark, that in addition to your Republican credentials, which are certainly there, you have been a pollster for media organizations. Channel 2 News has used you over the years. And I've always said you are one of the most fair-minded, straightforward pollsters out there, despite your Republican credentials.
Despite?
Well, you know what I'm saying. My point is you're not off there, twisting numbers for Republicans. And 538, Nate Silver's online publication, which rates polling organizations, you shared an article with me that puts you up in one of the top most trustworthy polling firms, right?
Yes. When we release a poll, we don't do what a lot of polling companies do in the end, and we don't do what's called advocacy polling. We don't get hired to come up with a result. If we release a result, we believe it's true.
Yeah.
Now, we can be wrong, but we believe it's true, and we do a lot of quality control. And the story you're talking about, 538 named us one of the 19 most trusted pollsters in the country.
Yeah. And they use metrics to determine that are so far beyond my mathematic abilities that all I say is, that's a good thing.
I won't complain as long as I have us up there.
Okay. Dove Wilker joins us today, too. He is the regional director, Southeastern regional director, Dove?
Southeast,
yeah. Of the American Jewish Committee. How many states do you have?
Six. I got Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, North and South Carolina.
Okay, terrific. And you've been there, it's been going on, what?
Eight years.
Wow, eight years. And he's still only 36 years
old. That's right.
Amazing. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
A little bit later in the show, we're going to get into some issues that relate very specifically to your mission at the AJC. So I'm really glad you could be here. But let's start, and of course, you can talk about anything you want while you're here, Dove. Let's start with the news, Mary Margaret, that you have another Democratic entrant into the U.S. Senate race. Teresa Tomlinson was the first to jump in, the former mayor of Columbus. Then Ted Terry jumped into the race, the mayor, current mayor of Clarkston. And Sarah Riggs Amico, who ran for lieutenant governor, was the Democratic candidate in 2018, and who a while back announced she was forming an exploratory committee, has now formally launched her bid, despite the fact that her company, one of the largest car hauling companies in the country, declared bankruptcy not long ago, something like perhaps as much as $2 billion in pension debt. And she says that's one of the things that encouraged her to get into this race, understanding the problems that businesses are having.
Sarah Amico ran a really good race, in my view. Of course, she did not win, but the lieutenant governor's race. And she made a lot of friends, and she presented herself in a very positive way as a business person who employed a very large union-based employment employees. I, full disclosure, am supporting Teresa Tomlinson, and think that Teresa has our best shot to win against the Republican senator. But we have to support Sarah's energy and her nerve to do this. I don't think it's the best time for her. I think that she does have a future, but I just don't think this year is the best year.
Why isn't this the best year for her?
Coming off a race so soon, and also, this is a serious business issue that requires serious attention, and I think that she will strengthen her future relationship with the voters if she attends to that first. I think that will help her and help her political future.
Okay, Mark, you know, she would make the point. I mean, she does say that she thinks the fact that her business, she's struggling, it gives her a better sense of what American business people, Georgia business people go through. And it is certainly true that Nathan Deal won a successful race for governor, despite the fact that he had terrible financial problems at the time that he ran. Brian Kemp had some financial difficulties that were a big part of the campaign, and yet he won. Stacey Abrams, with her debts, which Republicans tried to make an issue of, seemed to overcome that in the fact that she came so close to Brian Kemp in the general election. So all that said, what do you think Republicans will do with the failure of Sarah Meeko's business?
You know, it is virtually incomprehensible that she would announce to run for Senate 20 days after filing a $2 billion bankruptcy. It was 20 days ago. This wasn't years ago. This wasn't during the Great Recession like Nathan Deal had to deal with. There were very difficult times for a lot of people in those days. This was 20 days ago, and I think there's going to be a lot of problems with the idea that she's going to go take a full-time job running for U.S. Senate instead of working full-time to deal with her creditor issues. I don't want to wax philosophic or be judgmental about her personally when I say that, and I mean that genuinely. But it is, there's virtually no other Georgian that would bankrupt on $2 billion and 20 days later announce for U.S. Senate. What is wrong with her?
I want to be careful about one aspect of this. The $2 billion figure that's been thrown out there has been suggested as a possible debt, being that far in the hole. To the best of my knowledge, it isn't certain that that's the amount. But Mark, nevertheless, your point is, his point is well made, Mary Margaret.
It's big, no matter what. And if I'm wrong on $2 billion, and
no,
billion,
that's been reported, but it's been reported as like what it possibly could amount to.
I reflect also personally, when I lost a campaign, a big campaign that I was thought I was going to be successful at, and my crowd of candidates, over half of them ran again for another office just 2 years later. I think there's a psychology of coming out of a campaign where somebody has told you you're wonderful and told you how great you're going to be, that you somehow have to extricate yourself from the world of political consultants, political pundits who have an opportunity to be influential. The fact that I waited a good number of years, beyond two, to run again, I think was enormously beneficial to me. To what extent she's being influenced by the vendor crowd in this race, to what extent she's been influenced by whoever it was the strongest supporter for her and lieutenant governor, is always curious to me. Because I've hired consultants, I've fired consultants, I've sued consultants, I've congratulated consultants, I've got a lot of reason to feel like I can credibly say, who's influencing her to make this race at this time?
Well, but it may be just as simple as you say. There are some people who get an appetite for running for office. You're out on the campaign trail. You've been through this. You're out on the campaign trail. People tell you how wonderful you are. You're shocked when you lose. But people then immediately start telling you again how wonderful you are and how you never should have lost the race. I mean,
they're going to help you with money and that you're going to have a great time. And,
you know who did an impressive thing after his loss, and this is a compliment to John Ossoff. John easily could have stepped right back into politics after losing to Karen Handel and run and raised a lot of money probably, and probably still would realistically have not won. But he could have run for governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, or another office, and he took time to fix his private life a little bit, I think, and to kind of settle down this enormous rush of, as you say, consultants and vendors and the folks that sort of make a living on political work. And he backed off. And I think that's why he's taken more seriously as a potential future candidate? Because two losses at this point, and most people are out. And I do want to actually acknowledge one thing, Bill, just what you pointed out. I may have the number wrong on the $2 billion, and I don't want to say anything that's not true, but it's a staggering amount.
Yeah, and again, I really don't want to belabor this, but no, that is the number that's been reported by media. It's just it's reported in the context of it could be as much as. I mean, we may find out that it's less, but you're right. It's still a staggering figure. Dove?
Well, to me, one of the interesting things is going to be how many candidates we ultimately have on the Democratic side. I mean, if we look at the 7th district is any sort of barometer for us, I mean, there's going to be a few more people that come into play, as well as considering, you know, what other demographics want to try to approach that seat. I think there's, so if you got three candidates so far, you've got Teresa Tomlinson, Ted Terry, and now Sarah Riggs Amico. You know, who are the other folks that are out there that are going to create a really tough primary fight? And to Mark's point, what sort of impact might that have in the future for people running for another seat again?
Because I believe it's still early in that race. It's still early, and we all are speculating. When I say all of us in the inside crowd, there are a number of different opportunities for a credible African-American candidate to get in that race, and that's what I'm speculating to myself about it. The race is not complete yet. The candidates
are not complete. Purdue is stronger than I think the Republican candidates were in 2018 because they were dealing with an open seat in a what ended up being sort of a watershed blue year with Congress going Democratic. Purdue is, I think, in a substantially stronger position because his business background, being focused on business, I think his political life is in a better shape than maybe an open
Purdue,
seat.
Purdue, I've said that, and Mary Margaret, I think that Democrats are correctly concerned about how strong a candidate
any
Purdue
incumbent,
is.
Any incumbent
yeah, but
is going to be stronger.
Purdue polls better. His favorables are higher than Kemp's. They're higher than President Trump's in Georgia at this point. Interesting, since he's tied himself at the hip to President Trump. And yet he's got better approval numbers than the president does here.
The only real races that we have that judged Trump was the 18 elections, which was a repudiation of Trump. So pollsters are relevant to me, and they mostly sometimes accurate, very frequently accurate, and they're certainly relevant to an inquiry. But I think the ground is just too uncertain right now for anybody to know with a whole lot of confidence about what's going to happen with President Trump in the next 15 months.
So, Dove, you're at an interesting place in terms of all this because you certainly pay attention to politics, but you're not of specifically elected politics, and certainly in Georgia. So do you imagine that that people are paying much attention to this race outside those of us who are, you know, in rooms like this, making our living talking about politics and engaged in politics?
So as working for a nonpartisan organization that deals with politics, I probably pay a little more attention than most. But I do think that people are maybe not right now, but when the primary season comes up and people have to think about who they're going to vote for, I do think that that's going to be when people are going to be talking about it. And there's going to be a lot of national exposure to this because, as you mentioned, Senator Perdue is closely aligned with the president. He's got, you know, he's polling very well here in Georgia. And, you know, similar to other races that we might have in Georgia, I think it's going to be people are going to be paying national attention here, and that'll influence what happens
so,
to us as well.
So, Mark, I want to, you know, we sort of pay attention to social media as the show is going on. Sometimes we try not to because there's so many people who have such unpleasant things to say about some of the people in the studio. But a woman who tweets as Aaron on the side of caution has an interesting tweet. She says, "I'm honestly shocked that Republicans can talk about what a weakness corporate bankruptcy is, given who the Republican president is at this very moment." Point well taken.
There is a difference that, again, we're talking a bankruptcy that was filed on August 7th. And it was her company's bankruptcy, not her personally, by the way. And that is an important distinction for Sarah Amico. Sarah Amico personally did not. But while what you're saying is true. And what Aaron says, I think there is truth to that. And there's always truth to people that get up on a high and mighty kind of approach and attack others when, frankly, members of their own party have committed sort of the same problems. But in this case, this is pretty egregious, I think. We're talking about the same month of a corporate bankruptcy, company bankruptcy.
I think, Mary Margaret, we get a sense, if Amico should win the primary, where a lot of Republican energy is going to be focused in this race.
We get the message now. It's the timing of the bankruptcy. So, we get the message that will be coming forward. It's hard to predict is what I keep saying to myself.
So before we leave the Senate race, let me ask you as a supporter of Teresa Tomlinson's a quick question. You know, Teresa used to be a panelist on the show with some regularity. We always enjoyed having her on the show. We knew from very early on that her sights were set on running in the Senate race. I'm having a hard time getting a handle. She's smart. She's appealing in many ways in terms of her ideas. I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around whether there's much traction at this point there or not. And you're a supporter of her, so I'd love your take on that.
Well, I think we are more focused on Trump and his viability and his day-to-day drama. We're always, at his intention, strategically, smartly or not, we're directed to look at him at a daily basis. And so I think any candidate running for the Georgia Senate seat is going to have a little trouble. But she has networks that we can acknowledge as being real strengths. Being a mayor of an important city in Georgia has put her in contact with all the mayors across the, and there are 500 cities out there across Georgia. Many of them are African-American mayors, men and women. Many of them are people who have worked closely with Teresa Tomlinson, and that's a tremendous asset. She also has an Atlanta base. She has a strong Democratic base, and she is got the Sweetbriar base. I mean, somebody who pulls Sweetbriar out of the ditch and put it back on a viable college.
Wait a minute. The sweet she can raise money out there.
I think that it relates to money, and it relates to moderates, and it relates to people that dealt with her in a wide variety of contexts. That's the point I'm making.
Oh, okay. Because what do we have, about four people from who graduated Sweetbriar in Georgia?
You're not around the circles I am, but we have a lot of... I think that the point I'm making is that she has a lot of different relationships across Georgia that are unique to her. And Columbus is a very important place in Georgia. I think that she brings a lot to the table, and I think it's very, very early in the Georgia U.S. Senate race.
All right, hey, let's do this. I'd love to... before we take a break, Dove, I'll bring you in on this one. Robert Jimison just pointed, and Tom, both in the control room, just pointed out something to me that will... obviously become a bigger issue as the race goes on. There's a tweet from Ted Terry, Clarkson mayor, running for U.S. Senate. Here's what he says, and he seems to have some documentation within the tweet. Ted Terry says, "I was proud to support Barack Obama when he ran for re-election. It's unfortunate that not all of my opponents feel the same way." And he appears to have a spreadsheet that shows that Amico was giving money to Mitt Romney when he was a candidate for president against Obama. We don't have the numbers. Terry seems to have some documentation of this. Dove, it's never good to be a Democrat giving money to a Republican. On the other hand, Teresa Tomlinson used to be a Republican, so who knows if they offset.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fair question, especially for moderates in Georgia. That might be an asset.
You got to figure Ted Terry had this ready to go.
I'm skipping right over Ted Terry. Social media is relevant to politics, and yesterday my social media post was, of course, what everybody else was in it. But in addition to recognizing National Dog Day yesterday, I said that I was appearing on NIGET today, and what would they like me to talk about?
Yeah.
Nobody asked me to talk about polling. Nobody wanted me to talk about who Mitt Romney got money from. They wanted to talk about the kind of issues that Georgians talk about, transportation, healthcare, Medicaid expansion, climate change. So we always have to be mindful that very There's a limited audience for the insider talk about politics. As successful as this show is, it's because not only we talk about insider stuff, we also talk about things across Georgia.
I want to get to a break and because we have a lot more to talk about, but I do want to respond quickly to that because I think the point is well taken. This show routinely takes up healthcare, transportation, issues like a right to choose or
right
481,
to life
right to life as well. I mean, so your tweeters are correct to say there are times we do inside politics, and we enjoy that. We like that, and so do
well,
I think a lot of our listeners. What do you got there?
Speaking, Amico gave 5 contributions to Romney,
okay.
Not one. And you know, they're available. You can read them yourself on FEC.gov.
But Dove Wilker makes an interesting point. I mean, that may be appealing to some of the moderate...
She's claiming that she switched parties because of Obamacare and the Republicans opposed it. And yet, in 2012, she opposed Obama and was donating to Romney. You tell me if that's legit.
All right. Well, it's going to be interesting to watch how that unfolds. Just put a period on it. Sarah Riggs Amico, now in the U.S. Senate race. There are 3 Democratic candidates at this point, and who knows who else might join in. Let's get a break out of the way and come back with more on Political Rewind.
Join us for GPB's gala event in the Fox Theater's Egyptian Ballroom on Saturday night, September 7th. The evening starts with a meet-and-greet cocktail reception with music legend Brenda Lee, followed by a 3-course dinner and dancing with live music. We'll celebrate Brenda Lee's accomplishments in the world of entertainment as she's presented with the first GPB Georgia Legend Award. Go to gpb.org/Brenda Lee to get your tickets before time runs out.
The man who ran over and killed Heather Heyer at the 2017 Charlottesville rally is going to prison for life. Now activists hope to punish those who organized the rally.
They talked about which weapons to bring, cracking skulls, and even whether they could claim self-defense if they drove cars into protesters, which is, of course, exactly what happened.
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
4 till 7 today on GPB and gpbnews.org.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Dove Wilker, let me start this conversation with you, because there's a really interesting effort underway at the Fulton County District Attorney's Office. Paul Howard, the DA in Fulton, leading the charge on this. Let's just go back in history very briefly. In 1913, a young girl, I think 13 years old, mm-hmm. Mary Fagan, was found murdered at the Atlanta Pencil Factory. Manager of the factory was a New York-born Jewish businessman, Leo Frank. We can go through a lot of narrative here that we don't have to. We cut to the chase and say he was arrested for the crime on very little evidence, mm-hmm. convicted in a rather heated trial that took place literally in the hot summer. There was a lot of question about the crowd that gathered outside the courthouse and were yelling things about mm-hmm. convicting Leo Frank. He was convicted, went to Milledgeville. What happened? He was sent to the jail, prison in Milledgeville. What happened next?
They commuted his sentence, and then
the governor commuted his death sentence.
Correct.
And he was in prison, waiting for an appeal.
Right.
Go ahead.
And then a mob came and got him out of the jail and drove him up to Marietta and strung him up and hanged him, lynched him from a tree in the middle of Marietta.
Yeah, considered to be one of the worst hate crimes.
Yeah.
Now, we have to say, I always feel it's important to make this point. Leo Frank was one of the few white people ever lynched in the United States. Mm-hmm. But let's put it in context. Black people were being lynched routinely,
right.
regularly, horrifically during the same period of time and beyond. So I always feel like we've got to say that.
Yeah, no, it's a fair point. But the mob was yelling Jewish epithets and slander. I mean, they were just rabid anti-Semites, and they wanted to take him, and they wanted to kill him. And it didn't matter what the facts of the case were. And there's right now, there's a question of they're looking to officially. He was pardoned in 1983, I believe
'86. Yeah.
It was a
conditional pardon. Yeah. It was Governor Joe Frank Harris, Mary Margaret, you'll know this, who they couldn't exonerate him. So what they did was they said because he was kidnapped from Milledgeville prison while he was waiting for appeals to take place, he was denied justice. And on that basis, they decided to give him that kind of conditional pardon.
Our friend Dale Schwartz was part of that active, successful effort to go partway towards correcting bad facts of Georgia's history. And I think it's time to renew a new examination of this case. We have a lot of discussion within our legal community and within society about conviction of the innocents. And we know that happens. We know it happens in today's world, and it certainly happened in the era of Leo Frank for black and white citizens. I think this is a positive effort by the district attorney. I think there is a excellent opportunity for further clearing of the record.
But is it based on sentiment that he was treated wrong? I mean, you had Tom Watson, a former U.S. A member of the U.S. House, a candidate for U.S. Senate for vice president at one point, who, after Frank was convicted, whipped people into an anti-Semitic frenzy about Leo Frank. And Mark, one of the reasons that Frank was lynched in Marietta is that's where Mary Fagan, the young girl who was sadly murdered, was from. And my good friend Steve Oney, who wrote the definitive book on this case, was the first to reveal that the lynch mob was made up of some of the most important citizens in Marietta, including the grandfather of Marie Barnes, wife of former Governor Roy Barnes, and other leaders in the community. So I wonder, is this based on they're digging for facts, they're looking at evidence, or is this a feeling that an injustice was done and we'd better make a strong statement?
Well, I think there are an awful lot of cases that would be overturned in history were they put on trial today. And if we're looking at it, as we should, knowing more about things that could have been done in those days that you couldn't do in those days. But it seems to me that if we're looking at it through the lens of 1914, it still was an egregious situation, regardless of anything else. And by today's standards, that trial would not have happened as it happened. There were open conversations about his religion. There was information in the newspapers that was very public. There was not a sequestration of the jury, I do not believe. There would have been my understanding of it, and I do not pretend to be an expert on this topic, but by today's standards, it would be overturned.
There are many reasons for appeal. Yeah, right. Go ahead,
Bill. I think one of the things that we should remember as well is that this was a significant anti-Semitic incident.
Right.
And for the Jewish community in the United States, it is known, it is taught. I mean, I'm from New Jersey. I went to school in New York, and I remember learning about the murder of Leo Frank as a young child in New York. So the implications today for revisiting the case, I think, is for the Jewish community, if not even for the state of Georgia, is very important.
Huge.
Because it would allow us, if it turns out they can overturn it, then it would right a wrong that has been a stain on Georgia.
It's also still relevant for Cobb County. You mentioned the people that were involved in the actual lynching. That's still a conversation in modern politics in Cobb County. Were you related to this lynch mob? I think that it's time. I think it would be a positive step for Georgia to overturn this conviction, and I think that there are good people doing good work to make it happen.
It is interesting. When I was in elementary school, this was a topic that we learned about as well. This was a topic at Smoke Rise Elementary in Stone Mountain, where I went to elementary school. We actually read about this and talked about this. And so it isn't something that Georgia has turned its back on in all these years, and I can say that just even looking at it when I would have been 13 years old.
Well, there's a particular irony that Mark went to school in the shadow of Stone Mountain Park, because one of the developments that came out of the lynching of Leo Frank, out of that entire episode, was the reformulation of
the KKK.
The KKK, right? Who met on the top of Stone Mountain Park. It was also the event that propelled the organization that I at one point worked for, the Anti-Defamation League, into new status as an American civil rights organization. So there are all sorts of repercussions from the case.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out. I was reading about it that the facts that they have and are able to research now, it's going to be an additional challenge for them, because once he was lynched, they sort of moved on. They didn't interview any of the suspects thoroughly, which your friend Steve Oney, he's got the Bible on the case.
Once he was arrested, they stopped their inquiries.
Exactly.
And there was enormous pressure put on the cops in those days by the Atlanta Constitution.
And the governor suffered politically for doing good thing.
Governor Slayton, when he issued the pardon, the story is, and there's no reason to think it wasn't true, he said to his wife, this will be the end of my career. It not only was the end of his political career, but he had to flee Georgia with his wife because crowds descended on his house, the governor's home, and were threatening to do violence to him. They fled the state. So it's a fascinating case. But let me put it into a larger context for a minute. It's interesting that Paul Howard takes this on at a time when we are examining, once again, the American soul, as it were, to say, what prejudices do we harbor? How are they being triggered right now in a way that they haven't been for some period of time? How have they been reawakened? And so here, Mark, comes a district attorney, Democratic district attorney, who says, let's see if we can lay this one to rest. Interesting in the context of the period, the time we're living in, where hatred has become so prominent in our lives again.
Well, just in responding to that, it's not only is your point valid, I think a lot of political people and a lot of media are now living almost entirely on dividing us all by race, by gender, by all demographics. And I don't know if it's fair to say that this is something that to particularly attribute to Howard or not, but
Paul Howard has formed an innocence office in his DA organization. So this case of Leo Frank is a very important example of what other cases he clearly intends to bring, and I applaud him for that.
Yeah. Dove, is life at the American Jewish Committee more challenging these days, given what we're dealing with in the atmosphere of our times?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, today I was at a lunch where I was talking about divisiveness in politics and the impact just within the Jewish community that we have. And Republican Jews don't necessarily want to talk to Democrat Jews. Democratic Jews don't want to talk to Republican Jews. I think what we're seeing in society as a whole is clearly taking hold of the Jewish community as well. Finding opportunities for people to come together to address, their differences of opinion, I couldn't think is a more important time, but it's more difficult for us to be able to do that because people don't necessarily want to enter into conversations to hear what somebody else thinks. They want to stick to their guns. They want to make sure that they're sort of the core of what they're arguing is strong. And, who cares what the other person says?
It's time to talk about the president? Is that what you're suggesting?
I do want to talk about, you want to get a break out of the way, and let's get our final break of the show out of the way a little earlier than usual. And when we come back, we'll do that. We're going to turn the page. We do want to talk a bit about the president and the way in which he's been talking about the American Jewish community, of which he is not a part, obviously. And we'll do that after this break.
Hi, I'm Ross Sorrell, GPB's reporter here in Atlanta, but I cover more than the state's largest city. I tell stories about the problems farmers in the southern part of Georgia are facing, and I report on transportation issues affecting the 13 metro Atlanta counties.
We believe express lanes is our way to manage the amount of traffic or demand to give those users the reliable trip times that they're looking for.
Stick with us to hear these stories and more. GPB News, stand with the facts.
On the next Fresh Air, our Emmy week continues with Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who's nominated for her work on the comedy series Fleabag, which she wrote and stars in as a single woman who's a feminist but suspects she's a bad one. And we'll hear from Patricia Arquette and Ben Stiller, who are nominated for their work on Escape at Dannemora. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 here on GPB and online at gpbnews.org.
Let's talk for a couple minutes. I just handed Mark Rountree, who runs Landmark Communications, founder and you're president, right? Isn't that the title? CEO? What's the title you give yourself?
President of Landmark Communications.
Very nice. Okay. Dove Wilker, who is the regional director, Southeast regional director of the American Jewish Committee, is here. And Mary Margaret Oliver, state representative from Decatur, is with us as well. Dove, let's listen. Last week, the president caused quite a flap. Before the break, we talked about the fact that there's a division now with the American Jewish community that you're quite aware of. And let's talk about whether the president is making that better or worse. Here are two. Well, let's play first. The first thing he had to say about Democrats who support Jewish Americans who support Democrats in an election. Let's listen.
I think any Jewish people that vote for a Democrat, I think it shows either a total lack of knowledge or great disloyalty.
He was talking, of course, about, he was riffing on Ilhan Omar, the so-called squad, which he says have behaved in anti-Semitic ways. And to some extent, Ilhan Omar has made some comments that I think people can rightfully look at questionably. So that happened one day, and then people got very upset about that and went back at him and asked him about it a second day. And here's what he said the second day.
In my opinion, the Democrats have gone very far away from Israel. I cannot understand how they can do that. They don't want to fund Israel. They want to take away foreign aid to Israel. They want to do a lot of bad things to Israel. In my opinion, you vote for a Democrat, you're being very disloyal to Jewish people, and you're being very disloyal to Israel. And only weak people would say anything other than that.
Okay, so Dove, to you first. Number one, why is it when the president talks about disloyalty to Israel that raises the hackles of many American Jews?
Yeah, so the question of dual loyalty is something that Jewish communities around the world have been facing for millennia. I mean, we've always been sort of put into two different buckets, Jews have always been seen as the other. So whether it was you're not loyal to America because you are loyal to Jews first, or once the state of Israel was founded, it became, oh, you're more loyal to the state of Israel than you are to America. It's clearly the loyalty charge is something that we've responded to for many members of Congress, unfortunately, over the past few years. But it's something that really creates concern in the community because we are Americans. I mean, I'm an American. I also am Jewish. And that's, it's two parts of my identity. But to question, to whom am I more loyal is something that, the Jewish community takes great concern.
So, Mark, there's the kind of aspect of this that creates some concerns about prejudice. But there is a very simple political equation in all of this as well. The one thing where you could almost always count on bipartisan cooperation in American politics was support for Israel. And it is certainly true that Ilhan Omar, maybe Rashida Tlaib, have opened a door a little bit towards people wondering what's going on here in terms of their feelings about Israel specifically, not necessarily Jews, but Israel. But yet the president is driving a wedge between partisan groups. Everybody supports Israel in this country for the most part in terms of members of Congress.
Yes, they do. But this has been a growing, it depends on your point of view, from my point of view, problem within the Democratic Party. And there is a splinter group in the Republican Party as well, though I think it's a much smaller group, that even going back to Cynthia McKinney as a congresswoman, there has been a growing number of people in the Democratic Party that are at best not supportive of Israel and at worst, I think, are fairly clearly racial in how they approach things. But if you look at Georgia yesterday.
Cynthia McKinney was an outlier. I mean, wasn't she back in that? We're talking
If you're part of the squad, she was a pioneer. So you got to look at it how you want to look at it. But, I mean, you know, I assume, Mary Margaret, you were a constituent of McKinney's at one point. I was a constituent. These are things that aren't secrets in Georgia. What's interesting is I was driving on 285 yesterday, and I drove directly past an intersection right near Cobb Parkway, I think it was, at Billy McKinney intersection, it said, on a sign. And Billy McKinney was probably most famous for his final days, where he goes on video, and I bet you it's still on YouTube, where he is screaming at the camera that the loss of Cynthia McKinney was due to the words, Jews, Jews,
yeah.
Jews. He's screaming
at
the camera.
That was a horrendous episode in Georgia politics, no doubt about that. Mary Margaret, you remember
these
it well.
Here's what is not an insider conversation and is the most damaging possible thing to our society and our democracy, and that is the use of bigotry and wedge issues to divide people. We know that that is the president's strategy. Everybody knows that. And to use Israel as his newest wedge issue and further polarizing a community that really, I agree with Dove, was a bipartisan support in general for. Clearly, Billy McKinney and Cynthia McKinney do not represent the views of the congressional district they represent, which includes the Beth Jacobs Committee and five other synagogues right in my district on La Vista Road. It's ridiculous that we keep falling in. It's not ridiculous. It's tragic that we keep falling into this trap of following this strategy of bully divisiveness that the president uses, and he's found a new way to use it, Israel.
Know, one of the things that I think we should always remember is one of the great successes of the American Jewish community has been the bipartisan support for Israel. And, you know, the squad represents four members of Congress. I mean, you know, there's a lot more. There's 431 other members, of which 398 at least are supportive of the U.S.-Israel relationship. And that's something that we need to continue to talk about and to promote, because it's what benefits America. You know, the U.S.-Israel relationship is about American values. It's about the Middle East. It's about sustaining democracies. I mean, Israel is one of only, I believe it's 10 countries who's had a continual democracy for the last 70-plus years. Think about that.
The Republican messaging, to use the word squad, is very, very heartbreaking, troubling. These are beautiful young women who successfully.
I thought they named themselves the squad. Now the president may use it in a derogatory manner, but I think they call themselves the squad.
These are beautiful young women who represent diversity in our society, who are successfully drawing attention positively and negatively, as many do politics. But to message this about this. To use the president's strategy, to follow the president's strategy of Israel is a wedge issue and we can blame these young women over here as part of it, is very disheartening.
I don't want to go too much further with this, because to me, one of the most interesting aspects of it is, are we going to end up being more divisive about a country, Israel, that America's supported for since its founding?
How can we not?
But, Mark, Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, especially, I think Presley and Ocasio-Cortez, I'm not sure. I mean, the president likes to lump them all together, but I do think the two of them, Tlaib and Omar, they have opened the door. You know, they were probably inappropriately denied entrance to Israel, members of Congress. It is also interesting, the point is made by Republicans that the entire trip they were making, there was no effort at all to balance it between Palestinian visits in Palestinian territories and with Israeli leaders. I have to say, I look at that and say, clearly they are interested in promoting the Palestinian cause without regard to what they might learn from Israel. I have to say, I think it's fair to be critical. The president's prejudicial conduct in terms of them, to me, goes over the edge. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that Trump goes over the edge, as you put it, on a lot of issues, as does Bernie Sanders, as does Trump. I mean, excuse me, as does Biden, as does Warren, as does, I mean, they're running for president. All of these people are president or running for president, excluding the squad, obviously. I'm talking about the presidential candidates. And they, this is the job, in a way, of a presidential candidate, is to draw attention to their point of view and to try to win votes. I don't see any value in, and you know, I won't, let me not talk about that. I was going to disagree with you on something, Mary Margaret, but I don't think that's appropriate for the show. But I do think that the call them what you will, the squad is a very divisive group on the issue. And Bill, you can't just say that it's limited to four people. And
I wouldn't say that.
You have Hank Johnson calling the settlers termites.
Yeah.
I mean, you have Farrakhan. You have Cory Booker regularly meeting with Farrakhan.
Wait.
This is
This is what's wrong. We work so hard at respectful conversation, and every now and then we run into an issue where it quickly escalates. And I understand that. The passions are intense.
Well, I think we're being respectful.
No, I know that, but it gets more intense. It strikes me. So I'm going to move on because I want to talk about polling for at least a couple minutes. But it does strike me that the bottom line on this, Dove, is it's making it harder for Israel to have a sure and consistent friend here if the president chooses to divide American Jews up on the basis of whether they're for or against Republicans or Democrats.
I'm struggling with that. I mean, I think that the American community supports the U.S.-Israel relationship. And I think for the most part, we recognize who the outliers are as a part of that conversation. And not just the Jewish organizations, but there's a lot of, you know, non-Jewish organizations that further the relationship with Israel, business, technology, defense. I mean, it goes so much deeper than just what the president
says. Fair enough.
Says.
All right. Let's get one last subject in. We're not going to get as much time as I'd hoped on it. Mark Rountree, you're the pollster. Monmouth just released a poll which shows now the Democratic field nationally is tied. Joe Biden has dropped pretty precipitously from his lead. And now you've got Warren and Sanders in the Monmouth poll at like 20% apiece, Biden with 19% left. So there's that. We also have matchups, fantasy matchups, between Trump and virtually every Democratic candidate. In most cases, the Democrats beat Trump. Here we are in August of 2019. Mr. Pollster, should we be paying any attention to these polls at all?
No, but not for the usual reason that it's just early. And that is we need to see who. Trump will not probably lose, I don't think, to a Democratic candidate in a head-to-head race, but that will not be the environment. The environment will be a Democrat probably on the extreme left of the Democratic Party. Biden is sinking at this point, and I kind of agree with other folks that have mentioned, I think that he is in serious political trouble. I think that you'll probably end up being Warren or Harris. That'll lead that ticket. But what we don't see yet is who is that third candidate, that Ross Perot candidate, or that Anderson candidate that was in the race with a third candidate, a true independent candidate. They normally come. Anderson was a Republican congressman. Yeah. Perot was nominally Republican. And it's really those candidates that are center-right that kind of end up can a lot of times mess up a presidential election for incumbents. And that's my point, is that the people that are running as the third party candidates right now, they're nothing. It's who is going to be that 8% candidate that may strip Trump of the presidency.
Mary Margaret, I'm old enough that I interviewed John Anderson when he was running as an independent candidate for president. The polling does point out the dilemma Democrats have, the electability as opposed to the candidates who push the envelope on the progressive issues that some want. It's a dilemma for your party.
It's a fascinating political time, primarily focused this year on the Democratic primary. Obviously, the mistake that was made by the Republican hierarchy to allow Donald Trump to move forward, to whatever extent they were in control, the mistake of the American people, who, of course, majority did vote not for him, but the 16 election is so devastating at this time that is so significantly damaging to our world leadership, to all the things we know are being damaged by the divisiveness of the president. Creates a extensively energetic focus on Democratic candidates. I think it's still very unknowable as to who's going to win this thing. I'm interested in your prediction. I'm listening carefully. I think it's unknowable at this point, and there's so much that is left to be decided, particularly in terms of not having any elections yet. I'm trying to discipline myself to not go over the edge of my hysteria and anxiety till at least
that
until...
strikes me. That strikes me as so correct. It we are so early in this process that all these concerns about, you know, who's going to emerge. The candidate who will emerge is the candidate who, starting in January and February, wins caucus in Iowa, wins a primary in New Hampshire. This will settle in a very dramatic way by the time we get into early next year.
I believe that there are five, six, seven Democratic candidates that are viable at this point.
You know what would be really entertaining would be to take those five or six candidates and have each of them debate the president. Do a 20-minute debate, right? How it would be entertaining. I mean, it'd be fascinating. It'd be interesting. It'd be entertaining.
Which is why you're in the world of nonprofits and civil rights, and not a campaign consultant.
Exactly.
That's for sure, Wilker. One last quick thing, Mark. Would you, as a pollster with a great reputation, do you want to be polling a year out of a race? Can you get valuable results that you can pass on either to a client, a political client, or a media partner?
We will be doing that very soon.
You will?
Yeah. The next time I'm on your show, probably.
When are you coming back with those figures?
2 weeks.
Good deal. It's a deal.
But I will tell you, the biggest problem, this is just quick, Biden's biggest problem is that his story is not compelling. He's not hitting it with... Warren is compelling, Harris is compelling, and Sanders is compelling, and then you have basically Biden in collapse. Somebody is going to emerge and I don't think it'll be Sanders, because I think Sanders is probably topped out at 20%.
But wouldn't you agree that the anxiety that Mary Margaret is feeling will resolve itself? This is so early, you know? It's too early to worry about that. Hillary Clinton was 20 points ahead of Barack Obama at this point in their race against one another.
Speaking of a party putting a candidate onto the people, which right. Trump won without superdelegates.
All right. We are completely out of time for today's show. Dove Wilker, Mary Margaret Oliver, Mark Rountree, it was really a pleasure to have you all here for a terrific conversation. I'm Bill Nygut. We've got another show for you at 2 o'clock tomorrow. Theron Johnson's going to be coming back, and Jackie Cushman will be here with him. They are always interesting together, so we'll see you tomorrow at 2.
Political Rewind with Bill Nygut is produced by Tom Faust and Robert Jemison. Our engineer is Jesse Neiswanger, with help from Alex Word and Deborah Gilbert. Bradley Gaines, Sarah Callis, and myself, Carly Browder, are our interns. If you miss any part of this show or want to listen to previous shows, you can find our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and always at gpbnews.org.